Welcome back, everybody, to Chew On This. I'm Emily, and today we're tackling a subject that feels increasingly close to home for anyone working in food or agriculture: animal disease. Once, outbreaks like bird flu or foot and mouth were rare headline-grabbing events that defined a moment in time, but today these moments seem to be overlapping and gaps between them are shrinking. In the UK, we've now seen consecutive years of high pathogenicity avian influenza outbreaks. Between November 22 and mid-March 25, around 7.2 million birds were culled due to HPAI. The 2024-25 outbreak alone recorded 81 confirmed poultry premises infected and at least 456 wild bird cases since October 24. Meanwhile, the risk from other serious diseases is mounting. For example, the risk rating for foot and mouth disease in the UK was raised from low to medium in January 25. And according to the National Audit Office, the UK's preparedness for a major animal disease outbreak is still rated at 20 out of 25, above the tolerance level of 16, meaning that we're exposed. At the same time, lumpy skin disease, once restricted to Africa and parts of Asia, is now moving through Europe. With climate change, global trade shifting, and vector patterns all playing a role, it's clear that animal disease isn't a background risk anymore, it's a constant one. And the consequences extend far beyond the farm gates. Every outbreak sends shockwaves through the food chain, impacting farmers, processors, retailers, and consumers alike. It disrupts trade, drives up prices, threatens food security, and erodes public confidence in the safety and stability of our food supply. So today we're asking, what's driving the rise in animal disease? How resilient are our current systems of surveillance, communication, and response? And crucially, are we as a food industry truly prepared for the next major animal health crisis? To help us unpack this, we've got a fantastic panel: Charles Vines, protein subject matter expert Oscar Mayer, Joseph Keating, agriculture and fisheries manager at Co-op, and Professor Philip Robinson, who is an expert in veterinary public health and epidemiology and deputy head of Harper and Keel Vet School. So to start, we'll go around the table, do some introductions, and Charles, will start with you. Welcome back.
Thank you. So yeah, Charles, I've worked in the industry for 12 years now, ended in 2013. I spent most of my career working in NPD and moved over to the technical side of things in December 2024. Of course, yeah, taking on the meat subject matter expert role.
So my name is Philip Robinson. I'm Professor of Veterinary Public Health at Harper and Keel Vet School and also Deputy Head of School. So I grew up on a farm in Northern Ireland and qualified from Glasgow University in the mid-90s, went into private veterinary practice, then moved into government, became a government veterinary officer in Northern Ireland and worked there for 12 years. Then went off to do a PhD and got sucked into academia, and I've been working in academia teaching since 2014.
And yeah, I'm Joseph. I work at the Co-op. I lead on all of farming and fisheries for the Co-op, so that includes all our protein, all our farm fish as well as produce within the business, and that's predominantly focused at that relationship with our supplier direct to farm, our sourcing standards, which includes both welfare and sustainability plans and actions. Been with the Co-op 5 years now, and before that I managed a regional team with the AHDB, which is the levy body, so that was knowledge exchange on farm. Spent a time with the National Farmers Union, and originally from the west of Ireland, from a small beef and sheep farm, and studied agricultural science in UCD.
Brilliant, thank you all very much, and thank you for joining us. So we'll start with our opening question. So in the last few years, we've seen a surge in animal disease outbreaks, bird flu seasons that never really end, blue tongue emerging again in the UK, and new threats like lumpy skin disease. To start us off, how close do you think we really are to full-blown food chain crisis, and what do you see as the main drivers behind the increase in outbreaks?
Yeah, I'll go first. So in terms of how close we are, I'd say very close, moving closer. As you mentioned in the introduction, we aren't really controlling our borders at all well. So it is more... It's operating more on a model that we're trusting people to obey the regulations rather than enforcing it, certainly in border ports. In terms of a crisis, we're largely talking about disease-focused crises, but there is also, of course, human action-related crises. Good examples would be, for example, the Russia-Ukraine war when that kicked off in early 2022, before they were able to secure an agreement on Black Sea trade. We saw about a 25% reduction in imports of sunflower oil, which, of course, at the time led companies like ourselves to rapidly get concessions on reusing rapeseed oil instead and push through artwork amends. And then, of course, the diseases don't even need to enter the UK to impact us, because a very good example in relatively recent history was the African swine fever outbreak in China. That took place over 2018, bled through into early 2019. And of course, the mass cullings that they instituted in response to that meant that the Chinese buyers, of course, flooded foreign markets to meet their own demand. And we saw things like pork trimmings going up in excess of 70% in about a 15-month period in terms of costs. So, yeah, something completely outside of our control. It still impacted us in a major way because, of course, us as a business, we ended up making lower margins, and of course, some of that ended up being passed on as cost increases to the final customer picking the products off the shelves. In terms of how close we are, it's worth noting on things like the DEFRA Stats pocketbook, they list we're only about 58% of the food we consume in this country is actually grown here. So we are heavily dependent on foreign exports. And of course, not every foreign market is able to match our own domestic regulations. It was saying about 58% is produced in the UK, about 24% comes from the EU, and the remaining 18% is fairly evenly split between Africa, Asia, North and South America, and non-EU Europe, with about 1% coming from Australasia. So yeah, like Australia, New Zealand, close really. And I'd say we've already been impacted several times.
Yes, I think we have reason to be very concerned. We're very much focused on the present, on the future. But I think we also need to learn from history. And I think the signs are very clear from history that if not full-blown crises in the food chain, we at least have crises in the food chain. They can be of various magnitudes. I have been a vet long enough to have lived through some of our major crises, including BSE back in the mid-90s, late 90s, early 2000s. I worked during foot and mouth disease in 2001, and also in blue tongue when it first appeared in the UK in 2007. And of course, we have the endemic disease that we continue to grapple with of bovine TB. The signs are there from the past. We have current threats in the present, and I share Charles's concern with the biosecurity of our borders. And we know that some of the significant outbreaks that we have had in the past have been connected with probably illegally imported animal products. That was certainly what we think about classical swine fever when that occurred in East Anglia in 2000, and also foot and mouth disease in 2001. We have the recent report, Biosecurity of the Borders, that has been released last month from the Environment, Food, Rural Affairs Committee, and that makes very concerning reading about illegal imports of meat products, particularly into the UK, and that very much concerns me as a vet. And we know that there are challenging conditions with what climate change is bringing us, and changes in vector distribution. Insects are very important in some key diseases, as you mentioned in your introduction, Emily. And so we have no place to be complacent. We have to be very much on the alert and learn from the past and apply it to the present and the future.
Yeah, I think there's... In terms of a crisis, I think I look at it in two ways. It's not necessarily how close we are, it's how prepared we are if something happened. And I think it's a different way of looking at it. I think from an industry point of view, businesses move quick. We move quickly with our suppliers. We try and address issues as they arise. We mentioned, obviously, past issues around diseases such as foot and mouth and BSE. But then the last two scares after that was dioxins and pork. And and then the Horsegate, for want to where there was, that was obviously bad actors at Horsegate within the industry. So there's different crises. It's how you respond to them. I think for me, there's a few different elements of that that we are seeing. You know, I'm not going to go over import controls and such on and the likes, but we have kind of a government level responsibility. Industry can move fast, but you can only move as fast within the controls and the speed at which government can work towards. There is challenges in terms of resourcing. It's a complicated structure, trading standards, APHA, DEFRA. That's just all on the animal side. And then also if it's a human health issue, obviously you have the Department of Health and other. So there's a lot of different groups, actions, bodies that has to oversee and manage. And are they set up and equipped to work with industry if something was to happen, and how prepared we are to work that through? So I do think there's some strategic things, even things as simple as databases to track movements, how up to date they are, how up to speed they are, how quick they are to respond to challenge, to actually know where the animals are, or newly imported, for example. So I think there's some building blocks that probably need investment, which don't always sound important, but they are when something goes wrong. I think the other things around being preparedness, there's a resilience piece of our supply chains, and there's a piece around climate change and adaptation. We mentioned some of these, we're calling them, you know, blue tongue or bird flu. I think they're moving to endemic rather than novel. I think in terms of bird flu, the industry now is well equipped in terms of how to manage within the controls. It's also, but it does depend on the extent to which we've already seen numbers increase. So I do think the industry is starting to adapt, but I do think there's some fundamentals of where does, you know, even simple things as competition law, where is it not competition law to try and make sure we're all managing our supply chains together and effectively that manages these outbreaks. And these are all the, I think these scenarios need to be worked through a bit more.
Brilliant. Thank you all very much. So Philip, I think we'll start the next section with you. How has the pattern of animal disease changed over the past decade? And are we seeing genuinely new threats, or is it more of a resurgence of familiar threats under new pressures?
I think it's a bit of both. I'll go back a little further than a decade and use blue tongue as an example. So blue tongue popped up in Northern Europe for the first time in 2006, and that surprised everyone in the veterinary community. And we still really don't have a satisfactory explanation as to how it first appeared in Northern Europe, but detected in the Netherlands, spreading into Belgium, Northern Germany, Northeastern France, and then moving across the channel, probably through windborne spread through midges, which are a vector for blue tongue virus, and cropping up in East Anglia in 2007. That was very successfully controlled in the UK across 2007-8 through vaccination. And the disease went away, and we thought, good, we've got rid of blue tongue. There were ongoing outbreaks of different serotypes of the virus in mainland Europe. But again, Northern Europe was largely free of blue tongue until 2 or 3 years ago. And then it reoccurs, a different serotype this time again, starting in the Netherlands, first detected there. And that spread back into the UK again, and we have ongoing challenges with blue tongue virus serotype 3. We've had a couple of occurrences of serotype 12 as well. So that's an example of a disease that was here, went away, and has come back again, which is a warning that we can never be complacent. We always have to be prepared for the unexpected. And animal disease tends to throw up surprises, and that's where the resilience that Joseph was mentioning comes in, and the preparedness. We have to be ready, and we have to expect that there will be these surprises. Foot and mouth disease is another very good example of a disease that, you know, we haven't had that in the UK since 2007. We had the huge outbreak in 2001, and then we all get a surprise when foot and mouth occurs in Germany in January this year. And then there were further outbreaks in Hungary and Slovakia. And those countries hadn't seen foot and mouth disease since the early 70s. So there's a disease that, again, had been away for a long time and comes back again and has had a huge economic impact. For example, in Germany, it's estimated that the foot and mouth, just affecting one farm this year, has cost them at least €1 billion. So we see the economic, the socioeconomic impact, the effect on markets and export markets and trade, and the very significant cost that a disease such as foot and mouth disease can cost. We have to be prepared. Our government has been on alert about foot and mouth disease this year. There have been import controls enacted that have affected the food chain and the supply chain earlier this year. And also the importance of personal imports of products of animal origin that holidaymakers can bring back to the country. We have to be very careful about that indeed. So the pressures are new. They're sometimes recurring. Bird flu, I would agree with Joseph, that appears to be something that's now endemic. The influenza virus undergoes mutations, genetic reassortment. We get different clades of the virus that produce new challenges. And that's why in the human population, there has to be a new vaccine strains developed each year for human vaccination. And it's the same in animals. Those challenges keep cropping up. But H5N1 has been the virus that's been most concerning since that really emerged around 1997 in the Far East, and then appeared in Scotland in 2005, and then became an issue that was very much on our radar. And as government veterinary officer, we were very much prepared for and expecting bird flu outbreaks, and those have occurred. We've had in more recent years, some years, particularly 2022-23, which is a particularly challenging winter for bird flu. But that's an ongoing challenge, and I don't expect that to go away anytime soon, because the virus seems to be adapting much more to our native wild bird populations rather than just the waterfowl that it used to be a problem in.
From what you're saying, especially the imports of illegal meats, a lot of it is in unsanitary conditions, which of course can allow disease to, or various pathogens to manifest at a much more rapid rate. A lot of it is meat that can be improperly declared, so that a lot of meat intended for commercial sale is declared as for personal use in order to try and get it seen as lower risk and lower chance of it being picked up by port authorities.
Perfect. And just on that point about border controls then, Charles, do you think the UK's current animal health import and export controls are robust enough to protect against these transboundary disease threats? Or did we lose some of that collaborative oversight when we left the EU?
I don't think it would surprise people at this point to say no. I definitely don't think so. The APHA currently has a vacancy rate of 20% for vets and last year it was 24% versus a sector-wide average of 10%. Again, they are significantly short-staffed and they are struggling against certainly private sector to actually staff themselves. Especially perishable goods, like the ones we're talking about, especially meat, things like meat, dairy, eggs, which can be so highly pathogenic. More of that comes through the short straits ports of entry than any other. So again, for people listening, we're talking about Dover, Folkestone, the Eurotunnel. I would say they're not staffing themselves sufficiently either. So, I mean, we know where the single biggest point of risk is, but it's not necessarily it's one thing to know it, it's another thing to actually control it. In terms of whether we've lost anything out of the EU, I think the biggest problem we've got is that we're still operating as if we were in the EU in actual practice, because the EU's checks are very good at catching things coming into the border. But one of the consequences of the free movement of goods is that as long as things are travelling from, say, the Netherlands to France, Germany to Italy, you're operating at that point. There's very few checks on internal borders. And at that point, you're operating on the assumption that each individual business is meeting EU regulations. So I'd say a lot of our ports, especially Dover, because of course it's facing France, and that's where the majority of not EU and non-EU imports are coming from. I'd say we are still essentially operating under that system. I'd say the biggest problem is things haven't changed post-Brexit when they really should have.
Thank you. And Joseph, have you got anything to add to either of those points?
To be honest, I think they probably covered it fairly well. I suppose from us, from a retail point, we are more British focused than our sourcing. So we have 100% British commitments on our fresh and frozen protein and meat. So it does make us slightly different. So our challenges are, obviously, we want to make sure that imports do come in, don't threaten our farmers. But yeah, it's a bit of the illegal importing, and the checking is probably a bit beyond my area of influence.
Philip, bird flu was once a seasonal challenge, and now I think everybody's agreed it feels endemic. What do you think is driving the shift, and how does it change the way that we should be thinking about control and surveillance?
Well, Keith, what's changing the shift is that the virus is adapting, and the virus is expanding its host range. And as I said earlier, I know that because of mutations and genetic reassortments of influenza virus, the native wild bird population we're finding is much more likely to be infected and to indeed die from avian influenza. There's ongoing surveillance on dead birds that are tested for the disease as part of the government's strategy of monitoring and surveillance for the disease. And if you look at the identification of the species of bird that are coming up positive for avian flu, we see that change, that shift. It's no longer just a problem of waterfowl. That is concerning because that means the disease is much more likely to become endemic within the UK and Ireland. We know that we've lost significant numbers of our native seabird populations, and that's been a crisis for nature and our wildlife populations. But in this discussion, we're particularly concerned about the threat to the food chain and the resilience of the food chain. And that means that we need to prepare, and the industry needs to prepare and always be ready, expecting avian influenza incursions. And that comes, there's national strategy, but there's also the importance of a very local and very individualised strategy in terms of moving from companies down to individual suppliers and primary production. So all units of production in the commercial sector have to be prepared. Their biosecurity has to be maximised to try and keep avian influenza virus away from commercial poultry. That, of course, is a particular challenge in the free-range sector, where once you have birds outside, we can exercise biosecurity to some extent, but you can't stop what's going to fall out of the sky or what's going to land on the pastures that the commercial birds are being reared on.
Yeah, so what's going to help themselves to the same water trough, basically.
Exactly. So the industry has to do everything it can, but I don't expect avian influenza just to disappear, and we have to adapt with that reality.
Yeah, and just sort of to add to Phil's point, because, of course, meat, poultry, broilers, they are very certainly in relation to other protein sources, quite short-lived and quite a quick turnaround. The issue we've really got is population of laying hens get affected, because it takes them about 9 months to reach maturity and start laying eggs. So when, I think this season, 24-25, we lost about 1.8 million laying hens. And so that, of course, creates a real shortfall in the domestic market, because it takes the better part of a year to recover that population and begin laying eggs again. And that, of course, creates a serious constraint on the number of birds that can go to slaughter on a weekly basis. I would say there's also, because it's all meant in with the best intentions, but you have things like the Better Chicken Commitment and the European Chicken Commitment on the continent. But where you're moving to longer, slower growing birds that instead of taking 5 to 7 weeks will instead take 7 to 9 weeks to grow, and where you're reducing stocking densities, that of course creates further constraints on supply, and the demand for poultry isn't going away, so you've got conflicts there. and sort of highlighted the issue with free range. It does, I mean, I don't have an answer for it at this right here and now, but it does highlight whether or not free range as a rearing system can really continue as it has, or if there's going to have to be some sort of barn-based compromise, because, yeah, with diseases like bird flu becoming endemic, the ease of infection, especially, yeah, with wild birds just pop out of the sky one day, help themselves to the same water trough that the commercial birds are drinking from, and there you go, you've potentially lost tens of thousands of birds in one incident.
It's a bit bleak. So we've spoken there a lot around biosecurity being like a preventative measure for and helping us to prepare when kind of bird flu season comes. But Joseph, from a retail perspective, obviously we can't make co-op stores biosecure to prevent the issue. So how does a retailer prepare for disease disrupting supply chain?
I suppose, yeah, it comes back to your sourcing policies. It comes back to, you know, where you're kind of who you're working with and your suppliers. So, you know, it's not the co-op that is going to control it completely. It's the processors we work with, and it's the farmers on the ground ultimately as well to help manage and mitigate some of these risks. You know, you mentioned on eggs, I don't think it's as long as 9 months for a chicken today. I think it's 4 or 5, but at peak production is a bit different. It's where these farms are located, where is the spread. Obviously, rules and regulation has an impact as well. So you mentioned free range status. There has been a change to the labeling laws to allow for farmers to better manage their flocks if there is in a zone, an AI surveillance zone or management zone. So there is changes happening. There's also investments in terms of innovations and be that vaccinations and so on. And I think for us as retailers is understanding the science, making sure we're protecting our brand and protecting food safety. But how do we work with our suppliers? So when you see the likes of AI, it has its impacts right across. That can be from broilers to layers, but it's working with our suppliers to manage those risks. I think a lot of the challenge we've seen with AI, yes, there's a reduction maybe on in flocks and availability. That hasn't necessarily impacted us as the co-op. What we've probably seen more of is more people come to the corner shop and the co-op to get their eggs because their other supplies are not as well stocked. On AI and broilers, actually, again, the issue, yes, it has impact on availability to a degree, but it's more of how our supplier manages the different surveillance zones, the different requirements for trucks, and how we actually work with the regulation to manage that. We haven't had a situation where it's the level has disrupted. I think where it comes to chickens, it's probably more grandparent stocks. It's those ultimate flocks that are the breeding center because they have a multiplier effect. And when they are disrupted, that's when you see a really big long-term challenges. I think for us, it's having those conversations with our suppliers. I think it's also understanding the consequences of where your supply comes from. We have seen imports from other countries come in, but they bring risks in themselves. So we've seen eggs, you've seen reported on eggs in terms of salmonella. So we've been very strong with our British commitments. I think for us, having your commitments and having that clearly communicated allows those businesses to invest, allows them to think to the future and build that an element of resilience. It doesn't mean we solve every problem and we can mitigate every single thing, but having those clear commitments for the industry allows for that some of that resilience in the system. And we've seen that come through a little bit when we did have, I think 3 years ago now, the eggs, the challenge on AI and especially on egg production. We managed that fairly well within our supply chain. I think there is some other risks where are more a UK level, not just any one retailer, is, you know, UK farming systems have evolved where you'll see egg production in kind of condensed in some areas. You might see poultry condensed in some areas. And are you spreading the geographic risk in terms of where the farms are? But again, some of these farms are suited in areas which makes are best suited to be in. So it's, again, it's how you manage in areas within your supply chain. So we do look where we source from. We look, is there a, you know, I suppose not necessarily in relation to animals, but you look in terms of crops and horticulture, are you picking areas that kind of over a year can manage the extremes and the differences in the seasons rather than just one area of the country? So there is a bit of that coming in. And also what we're starting to do with our suppliers is chatting through of what if scenarios. What if these things happen? How do we manage that? How do we as a business allow them to move quick? Where are the stumbling blocks from us as a retailer that might kind of reduce the speed at which they can react? But also then what do we need to support either via ourselves as a retailer, but via the likes of the BRC in terms of enabling the government to make decisions that allow to react quickly. So you've seen some of those regulations and stuff, Ukraine war, you see a swift move, a quick move by government to allow some at speed changes to mitigate the impact. So there's kind of different levels, I suppose, from a retailer of how we work with them.
So I know we've spoken before about traceability, about movement documents and when disease strikes or hits, knowing where animals are and where they're located to manage those risks. But Charles, are you aware of any kind of emerging technologies, maybe precision livestock monitoring or anything that could transform how we prevent and control animal diseases?
Yeah. Yeah, as sort of mentioned earlier, DEFRA are in the middle of trying to build a multi-species platform. You do cattle as a good example because you have private initiatives like the Identigen system that most retailers now use. It's essentially a DNA tracing system. You can trace cattle back to farm. But of course, people that aren't signing up to those sort of schemes are still working on essentially paper-based methods that have been in place since 1998, which were brought in response to BSE. So that would be and also having it multi-species. So being able to track everything on one platform would certainly make things a lot easier and a lot more transparent. It's just then relying on the government to actually fund and implement and actually bring it through in a timely manner. In terms of other technologies that could be used, we've talked about vaccines and especially with things like bird flu. We might be familiar with things like the COVID vaccine, but RNA and mRNA technology to basically work as a modular platform, especially for rapidly mutating viruses like influenza. Those are being worked on, but of course the issue is they've got very limited approval at this stage. It's a very new technology in humans, and it's very much the same for animals. The French have, so they've had a combination of vaccination and what's called DIVA, differentiating infected from vaccinating animal system, which they've used in their domestic duck production. And that has seen quite promising results in terms of surveillance and being able to effectively single out and isolate infected animals. So that's potentially something that could be used. I mean, we've talked, of course, because it's such a hot topic at the moment, bird flu, but there are other viruses. So talking about pigs, porcine reproductive and respiratory syndrome. There has been work on essentially genetically modified pigs to make them more resistant. that initial results on that came out earlier this year around April, May. But of course, especially retailers, there's really a blanket ban on genetically modified foods at the moment. So of course, actually seeing anything like that come to market is a long way off. And there's things like CRISPR. So in terms of gene editing, because work has been done on trying to develop AI tolerant chickens, but again, you've got the hurdle of genetically modified, and you've also got the ethical consideration that on one side you are improving the chickens' welfare, the not just chickens, poultry's welfare by making them disease resistant, but at the same time, yeah, gene modification, there is ethical considerations there, especially for especially in religious quarters as well.
Anybody want to add to that?
Just on, I think I'm conscious we can get into a cycle of doom. When it comes to traceability, we need to remember we're ahead of a lot of countries. You know, BCB, so the British cattle movement system was ahead of its time. It identifies every animal in the country, bovine, and also assigns who is the keeper of those animals. Now, has it moved with the times, and does it need an investment? Yes, I think DEFRA recognised that. We also have a sheep tracing system. We also have supply chains like pig and poultry that are very integrated and they're very well mapped out. So I think when it comes to traceability, in terms of, you know, we can trace back animals within our supply chain, you know, can that be sped up a little bit through better government systems? Definitely. But that, I don't want to, I suppose, give the impression that it's not there to begin with. So I do think, yes, there is improvements that we can become. I think for me, when it comes to traceability, and I suppose by way of a background, I actually worked for a little while on some of that cattle tracing systems when I was with the levy body. It's not so much what they do, it's how they interact with the various different services within DEFRA. The different governments, you mentioned APHA, you mentioned how vets can feed in, independent and private vets. So it's more interoperability than the ability of what it does. And that needs the modern approach into it. So that's kind of that's one side of the coin. The other side around adaptation and what we look at, we have to, again, some of this is speed at which we invest. There is a challenge for companies when it comes to investing in animal medicine, because you never know the uptake. So it's a lot of money, you know, to invest in these new vaccines. But depending on the level, I remember I was with the National Farmers Union, and Schmallenberg was a big unknown and a challenge to the industry. And I think, you know, we've had cases of, but it probably didn't have the impact that was first worried. That took a lot of investment to have a vaccine for that, but I suppose that long term probably hasn't been, touch wood, as needed. So there's a lot of different caveats. I think on gene editing and CRISPR, and that is, we need to remember consumers as well. And I think consumers' acceptance of this technology is a long way off. And I think, as I mentioned, there is other inherent risks of what are you turning off, as well as what are you turning on in terms of protections. I think there's a lot more in the middle ground that can be done, looking around vaccines, looking around what does, be it at a government level or an industry level, give the confidence to that investment to happen. And then even novel technologies on farm, what can maybe not reduce, but we mentioned wild birds, for example. You might be able to completely reduce the risk, but we've seen this year, for example, on game farms or where there's shoots, that they should be protecting their feed stations and their water from wild birds, and trying to reduce some of that contact. So I think there's various kind of different levels, but I think traceability, I think we are in a good place, but probably more can be done on it.
Can I just pick up on what Joseph said and agree with him on traceability? I think we have lots to be positive about in terms of traceability in the UK. And I think, you know, if you look back to what has changed traceability in our livestock, particularly in cattle and sheep, we think back to the late 90s and the BSE crisis really drove through national and European Union legislation changes in traceability, tagging, identification, registration and so on of cattle. Foot and mouth really changed the traceability of sheep afterwards in terms of electronic identification and so on. And I think those crises drove changes in traceability that have been good. And I think the important lesson is, if we have a crisis, we have to rebuild back better. And I think no one would want to go back to a lower standard of traceability. We just need to keep advancing that.
Yeah. I mean, I'll add on to that in terms of traceability, because a lot of it is while our domestic systems are good, a lot of it is paper-based. And while farmers will fill out their passports, they'll they'll hand them over when the animals go to the slaughterhouses and the meat processors. A lot of that information, certainly on a day-to-day basis, is essentially held in companies. In companies' systems, and then it gets uploaded into, the APHA's portal system. And I'd say where the multi-species platform would really come in is sort of making it more transparent, and where time is of the essence, trying to identify where outbreaks have occurred, and trying to minimise the number of cullings that need to occur. Something like that would be of great benefit. So I'd say, our domestic traceability systems are good, but being able to respond in as timely a manner as possible, there is when a disease outbreak occurs, it does help.
I think we've probably talked. I think it's not so much when a disease or disease outbreak would happen. There's a lockdown, and the zone around that lockdown vary depending on what it is. And I'm by no means an animal health expert to say what that is. What an improved database would do, it's not knowing necessarily stopping that lockdown. It's the at speed at which those restrictions are lifted by being able to have those interoperable systems. So in terms of the UK managing it, if something did happen tomorrow, there would be a X mile radius and all farms would be stopped and shut down. It's the speed at which then you have that, I think as mentioned, have those interoperable systems to actually start either expanding or reducing that zone, because you're getting to the data quicker.
Brilliant, thank you. And then if we kind of look less domestically and more globally, we've just spoken about speed of notification kind of internally in the UK, but what about on a global level? So global data sharing and international coordination in predicting and preventing these outbreaks, how can we improve that, or is it good enough at the moment?
I would say the only body that could really do it at the moment is probably the WOAH. The World Organization of Animal Health. There were some fairly interesting stats that also came out of the DEFRA pocketbook. The most up-to-date ones they've had from 2023 highlights the Global One Health Index for food security. And they basically give a ranking on five categories, food demand and supply being one, food safety, nutrition, natural and social circumstances, so like human action, and then government support and resources being the fifth. They were highlighting that, and I'd say I don't think very much has changed in the last 2 years, that Sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia scored particularly low on things like food safety and a high burden of foodborne illnesses. And like we know, for example, China, especially southern China with its tropical conditions, it's a haven for the development of pathogenic microorganisms. Sub-Saharan Africa, when you get to places like the Congo, again, it's those tropical environments. We know that's where a lot of viruses can proliferate easily. Whereas they like Europe, Central Asia, East Asia and the Pacific had higher scores. One of the things that also highlighted was that almost everyone globally performed poorly in terms of government support and regulation. So it's not necessarily a domestic issue. It's it's a global issue. But in that regard, I'd say that, there's probably a lot more that could be done. I'd say it may be a nice to have. But whether or not the WOAH could actually implement a system like that, I'm really not sure about their capabilities.
I think one of the challenges we have is that we think globally, some of the countries which, I think particularly of developing countries, particularly in the global south, countries where we might think newly emerging diseases might be more likely to emerge because of interactions between wildlife, livestock and humans. Those countries just don't have the infrastructures for surveillance of disease. They just don't have the money to invest in the laboratories, the diagnostic capabilities, or the state veterinary services that they would really need to identify those emerging threats. And that's concerning for the whole world, because with the world being so small in many ways, with globalization and very fast movement of people and products from one side of the world to the other, and not much more than 24 hours really, we have that potential for what we call fomite spread, so contaminated objects or people carrying pathogens on their persons, on their footwear and so on. What we've mentioned before about the threat from personal imports of illegal meat products, animal products. We have a threat that could be on the far side of the world and could crop up in Europe at any time. And that's frightening. That places some onus on those countries which have more capability financially to be able to invest and help those countries that are struggling, because it's ultimately in our interests as well as theirs that those threats are identified and predicted as best we can.
Have you got anything to add, Joseph, before we move on?
Again, I think it separating two things out. There's food safety, and there's maybe disease and pathogens that might be a risk to livestock production. In terms of food safety, there is sanitary FISO standards in place. In terms of, you know, protein imports into the UK, predominantly EU. Beyond that, maybe Thai for chicken, Thailand for chicken, and New Zealand for lamb, and they're well established standards. I think the risk, I think as mentioned, is what's the resourcing at an airport where someone has a sandwich and a small level of air vacuum packed meat. So there are risks in there. I think there is the advantage of the UK being an island, means we can better manage it. Where we have seen some of these issues spread, they have spread from parts of Northern Africa, maybe into Europe, and then obviously you've seen cases bounce around. How do you manage that at a European level? We have, in terms of the flow of information sharing, there is a lot of things out there that does come through. You know, when we've seen cases arise, we do have risks within our business. Our technical team regularly monitor the risks of products, not necessarily ones we source from, but just products, areas of the world where, depending on the product, where there could be a risk associated with that, few various different issues. So I think there is a level of information out there. I think some of those challenges are, again, it's beyond necessarily supply chain should be doing everything it can to manage the risk within a supply chain, but some of them are bigger than just, you know, a retail supply chain, especially when you mentioned people traveling. It's a huge risk that's hard to manage.
To give them credit, one of the good things they do quite well is horizon scanning, and in terms of risk assessment reports. So, for example, where we've had things like the foot and mouth disease outbreaks in Europe, we've had sheep pox in places like Greece and Bulgaria. They do have periodic updates in terms of not only risk assessment for the UK, but also monitoring disease outbreaks in foreign countries and where it's spreading. So I'd say, at least domestically, they are quite good at identifying risks and where they're coming from. It's more sort of how do we actually turn that into implementation, and how do we better protect the country, I'd say.
Brilliant, thank you. And I think probably luckily for this podcast, Charles, I don't think DEFRA and the HDB listen. So hopefully. What we'll do, I'm just very conscious of time. We're going to move on to some rapid fire now, but thank you. I think there's a lot more that we probably could talk about because it's a big topic, but we're going to move on to some rapid fire. So Philip, we'll start with you. from a public health perspective, because that's something that we've not considered so far today, which animal disease should worry us the most?
This is not a new problem, but Salmonella concerns me, and that's something that's always here. It's an endemic disease, and Campylobacter, again, endemic, has been here a long time. Those are two of the most common diseases of foodborne illness in people, particularly Campylobacter. That's the top, in fact, in all developed countries. And that places an onus on the industry, processors, retailers, and consumers themselves, because ultimately the consumer is the ultimate control in terms of their behaviours in the kitchen, how they handle raw meat products, how they cook and prepare and so on. So those are not new diseases, but I think they're still of concern, and we know from the evidence that they cause a lot of foodborne illness.
Joseph, which system's more resilient to disease shocks? Is it farming, processing, or retail?
There's a quick app. I don't think it's one system or a chain, so we have to work together to be resilient. So I don't think you can pull one off the other. So for me, every element needs to build that in, and we need to make sure we're supporting, be it the farm and our working our processes, and then onto our shelves.
Charles, commercially, which disease would hit the food industry the hardest?
I would say it's definitely been bird flu.
Joseph, which causes more panic, a DEFRA alert or an empty supermarket shelf?
Well, thankfully, I don't work in technical, so I don't get all the DEFRA alerts. Look, at the end of the day, we're a retailer to sell food to our members. You know, we have 7 million members in the co-op, so obviously we don't want empty shelves. I think it's hard to pick it out. You need to know the exact case. For us, we need to make sure we have product on shelf that meets our customers' requirements. I think on the alert, depends what it is.
Thanks. Charles, which spreads faster, avian influenza or misinformation about it?
It's probably a close run thing. I'd probably say the misinformation.
Okay, and we'll finish, Philip, with, if you could eradicate one livestock disease tomorrow, which would make the biggest difference?
For me, that would have to be bovine tuberculosis. That's been our endemic challenge we've grappled with for decades. It weighs down the industry in terms of testing, restrictions, and causes a lot of heartache and stress for farmers and vets and the whole industry. And if there's one disease, it would be bovine TB for me.
Thank you. And we've got one closing question before we open up to our audience. So, Joseph, we'll start with you. Looking ahead, what's the single most important investment that the retail sector could make to strengthen the food chain against animal disease?
I suppose this is probably less of a co-op and more the son of a farmer. We need to make sure we're working with our farmers and our suppliers. So it's the investment in your supply chain. You know, at the co-op, we've invested over 800,000 this year directly onto our beef, lamb and dairy farms for sustainability payments. And that's what builds in resilience. That gives farmers the ability to adapt and change and invest for the future. So, you know, as someone who works with our farming industry day in, day out, I always make a strong case for making sure that investment goes back to those primary producers.
I would absolutely agree with Joseph, and I speak as a farmer's son as well as a vet and an academic. I think if the industry invests in its primary producers, we secure the future of the industry. I know that farmers are under a lot of pressure, and we need to remunerate them well, incentivize them. If we're thinking of disease prevention and safety of the food chain, we need to incentivize biosecurity, help with biosecurity education, but also allow farmers the time and space to think about their business, their adaptability, how they respond to the disease threats that are out there. And when they're happy and well-resourced, they will do a great job in supplying the food that the nation needs.
Yeah. I'll add a little bit more onto the end of that to say, I mean, the public has very strong confidence and a desire for British produce. I mean, you see the British flag at every opportunity, and we have for decades and for good reason. I'd say there's definitely work that can be done in terms of, I mean, there's compensation programs for farmers when livestock have to be culled for whatever reason, and perhaps those could be reviewed. And just to add on to Phil's point, I'd say farmers are under quite a significant amount of pressure commercially, and they have been for a while now. And I'd say in terms of government policy and non-food related policy, we don't necessarily food production is a low priority in terms of how we use the land in this country. So you look at livestock farming especially, and especially with the bad press it's cattle in particular have gotten in relation to climate. We've had a lot of farmers leaving the industry. The number of herds are going down, livestock populations are going down, and really sort of supporting farmers and encouraging people to get back into the industry would be a good way of actually making us more resilient and less dependent on foreign imports.
Brilliant. Thank you all very much. I'm going to hand over to the audience. So if people have got questions, can you introduce yourself before you ask?
Thank you. Hi, Nick Beniston, Technical Director for Oscar Mayer. So today's chew on this was around being, are we prepared? That was the question. And the National Audit Office raised alarms that the UK government is underprepared to deal with such crises, with systemic weaknesses in the country's ability to prevent, detect, and respond to animal disease threats. And the current approach is reactive and need to improve coordination amongst government bodies and things like enhanced surveillance systems. So we have touched on pieces of that. So my question for the panel is, what actions do we need to take as a food industry, so manufacturing and retail, to push the government to put this into place and drive it forward? Because if we're not prepared, what do we need to do? How do we need to help them to get it prepared? Open to everybody.
I think I'd say some of that it's starting to happen. So you have IGD and like the ERC feeding into it as well, where there's a lot of discussions now happening at a kind of a high level at industry, talking about what's needed in the future. Now, it's not necessarily just animal diseases, but it's around that piece around resilience. There's been a number of reports from IGG just these last couple of weeks. Some of that's focused on sustainability and climate change and the impacts of climate change, and you know the impacts if we don't act and the cost of not acting, as well as the benefit of kind of trying to do something now. So I think I've seen in the last probably 12 months, there's a lot more conversation happening around the piece around resilience. And resilience is multifactorial. It's not just animal disease, or it's not just sustainability. So I think those conversations are starting to happen. I know obviously through the work of the likes of the IGD or through the work of the BRC, that's been raised as well at government and government levels. We have seen obviously the plan land use framework being published, which again is part or being proposed is part of that piece as well of how, you know, we need a conversation around what food we produce, where we produce the food, what types of food do we produce. You know, we talk about animals a lot, but also we know horticulture has a huge opportunity within the UK as well. So I think it's a very rounded discussion that's needed. I think the challenge is sometimes we focus on a point and we don't kind of take that total round picture. My ambition, you know, we keep the conversations going with governments and we need that food strategy. And this is a key element of that. And it's a strategy, you know, we've seen in other countries where they have a comprehensive food strategy, the changes that can do and deliver. We've seen it in Ireland as well. So I think that's kind of means that you need a holistic building block, and then the streams can come out of it of how you work on those various different plans.
Yeah, I suppose to add to that, I would say DEFRA is probably quite a neglected government department, especially in relations to others. When decisions around where to spend money come through, I don't think DEFRA tends to get very high priority. And in terms of ministers, I don't think they've had necessarily the most high profile or forceful ministers. And of course, it's a department that tends to get shouted down and overshadowed by much more pressing concerns. So in terms of referring back to the National Audit Office report, you do see discussions in the trades, but getting those discussions into more mainstream publications, be it social media or newspapers, etc., just highlighting the cost of not acting, because it's very easy to say, oh, do we really want to spend $2 billion on Weybridge when we can spend $2 billion on, be it education, policing, etc. But of course, what that could do to our own domestic food production should a disease outbreak occur. Of course, as we mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, the impact of one foot and mouth outbreak in northeast Germany cost them in excess of €1 billion. If that happened here, that could easily cost us multiple billions.
I think we need to learn the lessons of history, and I've said this before, and these are not new debates and discussions. I was doing some research recently and looking at Parliament Hansard records from the early 70s, where the issues of, do we have enough vets? Do we have strong enough state veterinary service? Do we have enough security at the ports? These were all discussions in Parliament in the 1970s. We've had reports over the years, we've had crises, we've had disease outbreaks, we've had challenges to the food supply chain, and we need to learn the lessons of history and expect the unexpected. And I think we in the agri-food sector need to speak with one voice. As Joseph mentioned earlier, we have one supply chain. We need to be united. We need to magnify the voices from the micro and local level right up to the macro and national level, and lobby government to emphasise the importance of these issues and the need for investment. Economics is the allocation of scarce resources. We always have challenges. We never have any limitless pot of money to fund some of the things we might like to see. But I think there needs to be a realisation and an acceptance of the importance of protecting the nation's borders, protecting the national food supply. And I think with reference to recent reports, such as the Public Accounts Committee report that you referenced in your question, and last month's EFRICOM Committee on Biosecurity at the Borders, we've got wake-up calls once again to renew the emphasis on debates that have been going on for decades.
John Dobson, head of ESG at Oscar Mayer. I've got a rapid-fire question first up, I guess, which makes it a bit simpler. Will climate change make matters worse, make matters better, or just make matters much more complicated?
I would say more complicated. As conditions change, different areas of the world will become much more hospitable or inhospitable to things like influenza, etc.
I would agree with Charles. I think it will become more complex because the assumptions of the past may not be the assumptions of the future. And we are having new distributions of diseases cropping up in unexpected places. Vectors, wildlife hosts are adapting their host range, and we've got that interface, that nexus between wildlife, livestock, agriculture, and humans and human health, and that is going to be complex and very interesting. As a vet, we're going to need a lot of vets, and my focus is on education of the next generation, and we focus very much on these issues.
I think, take a step back, climate change, if we don't do anything about it, is going to make everyone's life worse. And that's why we have our targets and our goals. Colleagues in the sustainability team alongside me are working on fair trade, looking at, for example, our tea, our cocoa, our bananas. And climate change is a serious risk to some probably impoverished communities who don't have the ability to adapt. From a UK point of view, it's going to make things more complicated. There's going to be opportunity for the UK, given our climate, our maritime more climate. Yes, it might warm, but it doesn't present necessarily the same level of risk of other areas. It might give opportunities for around production and different crops, but I think it will definitely make it complicated. I think if as a whole world we do nothing, it'll definitely make it worse. I think the science is pretty clear on that one.
I did have a longer second part bit. So obviously climate change is one of the existential crises facing us all, and nature loss and is another one. We've seen from recent legislation around EU deforestation regs that even having due diligence systems and the data requirements there are pretty tricky for a limited set of commodities. Do you think, because you've all spoken about sort of moving from paper passports in cattle to more digital means, do we think we have the databases and systems set up or anywhere near set up to be able to cope with that amount of data and complexity? That's the harder question, by the way.
That's right. Domestically, I'd say we do. Probably the biggest issue is communication between departments. I'd say not everyone who needs to see the information sees it in a timely manner. It's not that it's not being collected, it's that we could certainly make it more easily accessible and more rapidly accessible. So that's a short answer.
I think one of the challenges is going to be is that the data collection systems and data storage systems themselves are going to have to be resilient. And we know that we have increasing challenges when things go wrong that can have global impacts, and we need to be ready for that as well.
I guess, sorry, if I'm just going to add on to that. Yeah, domestic energy production, not food related at all, but one of the consequences of moving everything to digital is, of course, we need to generate a lot more electricity. And relying on importing electricity from using cables from, say, France and Norway isn't necessarily the smartest thing to do. So do we need a more robust domestic energy production system in order to be able to implement and use these systems in the future?
You've really got anything to add?
Charles, in terms of the question, you know, can we build the databases and have the systems? Yes, but it's not a... it's not a database issue, it's joining all the dots, I think, more so.
So thank you all for joining us, and thank you to the panel. I think you've been wonderful, you've been brilliant, and I hope that this episode has given you all something to chew on.